I next met with Dr. Ingrid Mayer from the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, and to begin, I asked her about a 43-year-old woman she treated who initially declined adjuvant therapy from her community-based oncologist, but then presented 3 years later with symptomatic metastatic disease.
So in 2012, this young woman presents with a 2.2-centimeter tumor, had one sentinel lymph node that had a macromet, but no other nodes were involved at that time. She was in at a different service, and Oncotype DX was obtained, and it was very low. It was an Oncotype DX score of 5. I'm not really sure what the discussion was at that point with her oncologist, but technically, she would have benefited from, evidently, endocrine therapy, and now with the data of the soft and text trials, like, she would be somebody who potentially would have benefited from ovarian suppression and an AI because of the positive lymph node. With an Oncotype DX that is very low, it's unclear if she would actually have had any benefit from chemotherapy, despite the fact that she had a positive lymph node. Unfortunately, at that time, she actually declined any form of treatment. She did not want to have radiation. She didn't want to have endocrine therapy and much less hear about chemotherapy. So she did okay. I'm not sure if the discussion was led in the ways that Oncotype DX score being low, she would have been okay anyway, which in many ways is partially true because the Oncotype DX signature has prognostic value as well, regardless if somebody actually takes or not endocrine therapy. But she obviously would have benefited from ovarian suppression and an AI at that time. Declined all forms of adjuvant therapy, including radiation, and 3 years later presents with a pathological fracture of the femur and gets admitted to the hospital in pain crisis. At that point, I saw her in the hospital for consultation immediately after her surgery that did confirm that her metastatic disease was indeed from her original ER-positive breast cancer. She was very scared, in a lot of pain.
So just from a teaching point of view, before you talk about how you approached her in terms of the metastatic disease, going back to that point 3 years earlier when she was originally diagnosed, first of all, I'm kind of curious, as you talked to her and met with her, what her background was in terms of refusing all therapy. What was the reasoning behind it?
So young women, when they present with breast cancer, I think there's a lot of image issues where she was a young mom. At that time, she was in her late 30s, very scared about the potential side effects that could happen with endocrine therapy, didn't want to have bad skin, bad hair, joint aches, and issues with her libido or other things. And at that point, I think she just thought, like, you know, they got it all out. I don't need anything else. Surgery is okay, and I'm going to be all right.
Let's talk, too, also about the issue of using genomic assays, including the one that she had, the recurrence score in early disease, because you were part of the landmark Taylor X study that was just presented and published, and I kind of want to get your take on that. But before we kind of get into Taylor X, I guess one issue this does bring up, as you mentioned, maybe we look at this a little differently now than we did a few months ago, is the use of genomic assays in patients with node-positive disease. It's interesting, kind of the ASCO guideline says don't do it, and yet when we ask investigators, most of them are doing it, specifically using the recurrence score, particularly if it's minimal nodal involvement, one node, as this woman had. Can you talk a little bit about the evidence that we have in node-positive disease and how you've been approaching it, at least up until Taylor X?
In node-positive disease, the evidence for using genomic signatures, such as the recurrence score signature, is not as strong. There are retrospective data that have been done, but clearly not as strong as the original one that was done for node-negative disease that included almost 20,000 patients in retrospective studies like NSABP B14 and B20. For lymph node-positive disease, the data is much more scanned, where the retrospective analysis was done in nothing but 700 patients. Interestingly enough, it's consistent, and because of that, in understanding that this is a signature that looks more at biology rather than anatomy problems, now there is an ongoing prospective trial called Responder X that is precisely asking the question of the value of genomic signatures in patients with limited lymph node involvement, between 1 and 3 lymph node involved, to see if the genomic signature could spare women with limited lymph node involvement from having to have chemotherapy and if they would do well with endocrine therapy alone, much like Taylor X has done for lymph node negative disease. Now, this particular patient, to be honest with you, What we see a lot in the community is that surgeons order genomic signatures once they get a biopsy of the primary tumor. So actually not having any knowledge if patients are going to have or not lymph node involvement. At a recent presentation, this particular patient did not have a high-grade tumor, had a fairly small cancer based on mammogram and ultrasound, which can, in young women, underestimate the size of the tumor just because of dense breasts, which this patient happened to have. So I think the thought process of the surgeon was, I don't think this patient is going to have a lymph node involvement. The tumor size is fairly small. The grade is not high. And he went ahead and, in the spirit of being helpful, ordered a signature. So we had the OncoTAP-Dx score result before she actually had the results of her final surgery that showed that she ultimately has stage 2 disease with one lymph node involved. So the reimbursement for recurrence score signature testing in lymph node positive is hit or miss. Some institutions are able to get it without any problem. We have never been successful in getting it approved, so typically we don't do it in our practice.
Wow, I'm really surprised to hear that.
We do get some reimbursement when we do that, but typically we can't really get a recurrence score testing in lymph node positive disease in most of the insurances we work with in Tennessee.
That is the first time I heard that. I've got to say I'm shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand. It's in the guidelines.
They'll approve MammoPrint. Yeah, they'll approve MammoPrint.
Really?
Yeah, but not a recurrence score. So I personally never gotten a recurrence score in somebody with a lymph node positive cancer.
You know, a lot of times when we ask people what they do, we say, well, let's put aside reimbursement issues. In general, would you want to use a genomic assay in situations of node positive disease? What kind of situations and which assay?
So for premenopausal women, I'll have to say that I'm a little skeptical about using it yet without seeing the prospective data, because premenopausal women are somewhat underrepresented in the retrospective analysis that was done for lymph node positive disease. And therefore, because of the higher risk added to the fact that now we are dealing with lymph node positive disease, I'll be a little scared, for lack of a better word, of not using chemotherapy in a young woman with involved lymph nodes, especially if it's more than one.
I think the other thing is that from what I've seen in the last couple of months, people are really looking at genomic assays, specifically the recurrence score, differently now than they did before ASCO. Because to me, until ASCO, we didn't really have the issue of premenopausal or young women. People kind of talked about it, but there wasn't the kind of data we have now from TAILORx. So I kind of have been hearing that it affects how people look at node-positive disease. But to get into that, let's talk about TAILORx, and we'll kind of come back to node positive. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can kind of walk us through basically the background of TAILORx, the major findings that were presented, and what you think it means in terms of taking care of patients.
Since the year 2000, as most of you remember, a guideline came through that anybody with 1 centimeter and above breast cancer, ER positive, needed to get chemotherapy because of the relative benefit that one would get in decreasing risk of recurrence and obviously some impact on survival by doing that. So it became obvious over time that not quite everybody really seemed to need chemotherapy, because when we make decisions about what adjuvant therapy needs to be given, it's not just about anatomical findings. Tumor biology probably is a lot more important than the anatomical findings in determining who's going to have a recurrence and whatnot. With the advent of genomic signatures, such as recurrence score and others, it became clear that prognostically, some patients seem to do really well with endocrine therapies alone. So the recurrence score signature is a good example where retrospective analysis of 2 very large trials comparing endocrine therapy plus minus chemotherapy in women that are at pre- and postmenopausal, obviously with a big predominance of postmenopausal women participating in the trials because of the epidemiology of breast cancer in general, it became clear that the signature such as recurrence score was very useful in determining patients that with lymph node negative disease and tumors between 1 and 5 centimeters really seem to be okay with endocrine therapy alone without needing chemotherapy. However, because of the way the signature is presented, where depending on how high of a score one gets, which that score is essentially a mathematical translation of how high the grade is, how much expression of ER and PR, if there's any expression of HER2 whatsoever, that translates into a mathematical formula that spills out the score, what I like to call now the olden days, between 0 and 11 was considered low score, equaling a low risk of recurrence, provided the patient took 5 years of endocrine therapy. In this case, within the retrospective data, tamoxifen was the endocrine therapy of use. For scores above 31 that were called a high score, also translating to a high risk of recurrence, which pretty much told us that endocrine therapy was probably not enough. And based on the NSABP-B20 data, we also realized that chemotherapy was helpful. So there was a predictive value of using chemotherapy in the high-risk score category as well. But the big question became what to do with the women in the intermediate score range between 18 and 31, where we really didn't know if chemotherapy was necessary or not. Even clinically, a lot of us struggle before the signatures were available with what to do with patients that didn't have big tumors but had lower grades and really seemed to have a more indolent tumor. And potentially, clinically, we may have chosen to forego chemotherapy in somebody who was postmenopausal and older. But nevertheless, the question was important because I think it became pretty clear with the retrospective data that we really could potentially spare more women if we knew what to do with the intermediate score, which was the brunt of the score that you'd get once you test women and in general. So TAILOR-X was a prospective study that was created to look specifically at what to do with this intermediate range score in OncoTAP-Dx. Now, the cutoffs for score were chosen a little bit of a different way. And I think the best way I have to summarize it is to really be able to capture the majority of women that get a score from OncoTAP-Dx that would fall into that intermediate range was one of the reasons for the different cutoff. But the main one was to really be as conservative as possible. And it's potentially better to overtreat than undertreat, if you will. So when you look at the curves of the graphs, if you look at the confidence intervals, if you really look at the lower bar of the confidence intervals and you get your cutoff to be a recurrence risk higher than 20% versus lower than 10%, the numbers you get is between 11 and 25 rather than 18 and 31, which is how they were chosen to begin with. So 11 and 25 became the quote-unquote new cutoff for the prospective trial, and that's how the TAILOR-S rolled out, where women that had a score above 25 received both chemotherapy and endocrine therapy and was not randomized. Women that had a score below 11 did not receive chemotherapy, only received endocrine therapy and were not randomized. And the women that had a score between 11 and 25, which really comprises about 65, almost 70% of all patients that end up getting an OncoTAP-Dx, were then randomized to receive chemotherapy or not in addition to endocrine therapy. And endocrine therapy was endocrine therapy of choice. So 10 years ago, it's when this trial has started, it accrued over 10,000 women, of which about 6,000 ended up being randomized in the intermediate range of score of 11 and 25. A good proportion of them were premenopausal women as well. A majority were still postmenopausal. And you fast forward long follow-up now of the trial, and what we learn is that women in the intermediate score range between 11 and 25 overall do not need chemotherapy, particularly the ones that are over 50 years of age. This was an arbitrary cutoff for a subset analysis to see if there was any advantage to use chemotherapy in women that were younger than 50 years of age, almost using it as a surrogate for premenopausal status. So in the women above 50 years of age, any score below 25 really did not benefit at all from the addition of chemotherapy. So endocrine therapy now is the new standard for women with this profile where tumors are typically under 3 centimeters, node negative, postmenopausal, they will do fine with endocrine therapy alone. Now, women that were younger, there was a little bit of a break off on the scores where if their score was still between 11 and 16, they really did not benefit from chemotherapy either. But a score between 16 and 20 and 21 and 25, the benefit from chemotherapy is actually higher. It's not great. It's not obviously like the same benefit that you'd get if the score was above 25, but there was some benefit, there was a difference where chemotherapy did seem to add in decreasing risk of recurrence in that group, particularly between a score of 21 and 25. So in this day and age, the take-home message is if you have a patient over 50 years of age with an OncoTAP-Dx score below 25, chemotherapy has no role and endocrine therapy alone should be the standard of care. For women that are under 50 years of age, if they have an OncoTAP-Dx score below 16, they are also okay using endocrine therapy alone. A score between 16 and 21, I would say a discussion needs to happen between the physician and that patient to discuss the value of chemotherapy, understanding that the impact is not huge, but there is an impact that can potentially be a little bit more substantial. So chemotherapy may be considered in those circumstances. And in scores between 21 and 25 for women that are young, I think a discussion with chemotherapy also needs to happen where the benefit is actually now a little bit larger and potentially would sway me to go ahead and use chemotherapy in those cases. Above 25, if the patient is premenopausal with a score 25 and higher, I would use chemotherapy. I'd make that recommendation without hesitation. And for a postmenopausal women, so women above 50, give or take, with a score between 25 and 31, I think I would discuss chemotherapy, but there may be cases where I wouldn't do it if there's a lot of comorbidities or the patient was substantially older, or where I think that the risk of death from other causes within the first 10 years would be greater. I may not consider chemotherapy in that group. But be it as it may, I think right now we are potentially able to save a lot more women than before in having to use chemotherapy, achieving the same outcome based on the genomic score signature.
So a few follow-up questions. You know, one issue about the younger premenopausal women, my understanding is that because the trial was done, you know, a few years back, the vast majority of these women did not have ovarian suppression or ablation. So then the issue comes up of, was this effect primarily just the chemo-induced ovarian suppression, or was it the chemotherapy? Any thoughts about that? And from that point of view, if you believe it is the ovarian suppression, do you feel a little bit less strongly about using the chemo as long as you're using ovarian suppression?
So unfortunately, when TAILORx was ongoing and women were being accrued to the trial, premenopausal women at that time, we did not have the knowledge of the soft and text trials. So majority of women that were premenopausal within TAILORx did not receive ovarian suppression. So we don't know in this day and age if the benefit that these premenopausal women are getting from chemotherapy with a score below 25 but above 16 is coming from the fact that chemotherapy causes amenorrhea in these premenopausal women, and that's where the benefit is coming from, where the tumor is still exquisitively sensitive to endocrine therapy and the benefits of chemo are really just by causing the amenorrhea, or if there is any different biology within a tumor, even ER-positive in a younger woman, where chemotherapy is being important just because these tumors may behave more like luminal B tumors and have less dependency on endocrine therapy. So unfortunately, this is a question that the trial did not set out to answer. And I think in not knowing that, I'd be very cautious about extrapolating that the only benefit that these women received from chemotherapy was because of the amenorrhea. So I think in those borderline cases where the score is between 16 and 21 in the premenopausal women, the discussion of potentially upgrading the endocrine therapy and foregoing chemotherapy is reasonable. But I'd be a little skeptical about doing that in women that have a score above 21.
So as I was mentioning, at least in my initial chats with investigators since ASCO, it's been interesting because, you know, with all the issues coming up about premenopausal, it's kind of interesting. It seems like people are now becoming more comfortable using the recurrence score in postmenopausal women with positive nodes because they kind of feel like the biology is playing out more straightforward. So for example, this woman with one positive node, a 2.2 centimeter tumor with a recurrence score of 5, if she had been, you know, age 60 and postmenopausal, would you have been comfortable withholding chemo?
Absolutely. So for somebody who is postmenopausal but seems to have a very, very favorable biology of disease as translated by a very low Oncotype DX score, despite one positive lymph node, I would feel very comfortable withholding chemotherapy in that case. But with the case in question that we were discussing in a premenopausal woman, I'm not quite that comfortable yet just because of the underrepresentation on the data so far.
And the other thing I've kind of heard about that, I see how you feel about it, is the idea that one node, okay, two or three nodes maybe, but not more than three nodes. Is that kind of the way you look at it, or just one node?
Probably. I mean, we do know that the prognosis gets worse with every single additional node that you collect. I mean, it really almost is a linear curve there. But I'm not sure there's that much of a difference between 1 and 2 nodes. It all depends on how long has the cancer been there. We all know women, for instance, that have these lobular cancers that don't pick up well on mammogram or ultrasound, and they've probably been there for God knows how many years. And finally, either the patient or the gynecologist feels something in the breast, ends up getting more diagnostic imaging, where then, boom, we found that they had like a 3-centimeter node and there's like 1 or 2 lymph nodes involved and it's a lobular cancer. So I'm not sure biologically that's a cancer that behaves badly, but it obviously has been there for longer and anatomically has had enough time to spread to the lymph nodes. That patient may have actually a better prognosis than somebody that has like a 2-3 centimeter triple negative high-grade breast cancer without any lymph node involvement. So I think nodes don't tell all the story, but it clearly says that cancer has the potential to leave the breast and go somewhere else. And if it's gotten from the breast to the lymph nodes, it could really have gotten anywhere.
What was your role in Taylor X?
So I was one of the co-investigators. I was part of when Dr. Sperano first presented the concept at ECOG. We all chipped in into trying to mold the trial into what it finally became. And ultimately, I was one of the co-investigators that participated within the creation of the trial and the patient accrual as well.
Okay, well, maybe you'll know the answer to this question. I asked Harold Burstein this the other day, and he didn't know. But according to my eyes, when I read that paper, you know, there's that big chart with the under age 50, right? There was this whole big table about data in the younger women, okay? And everybody was focusing on the intermediate. But if you look at that, if you look up at the good risk in that table, because they didn't do that with the postmenopausal women, at least maybe it was in the appendix, but I didn't see it in the paper. But if you look at the top, the good risk, to my eyes, it looks like the 9-year disease-free survival, because that was reported 9 years, right? Okay. For the good risk premenopausal was 87%. So that's not good. Right?
It's not as great as the postmenopausal women.
But I'm just saying, is that true, though? But you see what I'm saying? Is the recurrence? I thought when you have low risk, you had previously demonstrated low risk had very, very low recurrences. But unless I misread this chart, it says 87%. That's not low.
You're right. I mean, that's what it says. That is not low. I mean, it's not horrible, but clearly they seem to be having a worse prognosis than the postmenopausal women, because if you look at the first iteration of Taylor X, where the data was published just for the women with a score below 11, I mean, everybody did great. I mean, the follow-up was awesome, and, you know, very few people had a recurrence. Like, it was above 95, almost like 98% benefit. Again, I think overall breast cancers in young women are a different beast. We know that with definitely triple negative breast cancers, they do have a worse outcome in young women than they have in older women. And I suspect it's probably the same issue in ER-positive disease as well as HER2-positive disease, where age itself seems to have an independent prognostic factor as well. When you look at the numbers proportionally, if you think about it, the patients that had a score between 16 and 20, they had a much better risk reduction, if you will, from chemotherapy than the women with a score of 21 to 25. Despite chemotherapy, they still had a proportional decrease on the risk of recurrence, but not as great as the other women. So I think in the big scheme of things, we can't just look at one factor in determining recurrence. And as I said, age in itself is a bad prognosis, like young age is a bad prognostic factor to begin with. So I think proportionally speaking, even though they did not benefit from chemotherapy having a lower score, they still didn't do as well as the postmenopausal women, where, you know, other things are at play. So I think all in all, I'm surprised, but perhaps not as surprised, where we just know that young women don't do so well.
Maybe it's a smaller number of patients, but I'd be curious to know the number in postmenopausal women, because I'm assuming it's closer to 95%, but, you know, I don't know.
Probably.
Anyhow,
yeah.
Let's get back to your case. Okay, so this lady has refused all therapy. She certainly should have had hormonal therapy and radiation therapy. But now you see her, she's got metastatic disease. And just in the bone or where else?
When she presented with her pathological fracture, like once she went through surgery, whatnot, we did full staging with bone scan and CAT scans. And her disease at that time was pretty much confined to the bones. She had a few very, very tiny pulmonary nodules. They were too tiny to biopsy, and it was unclear if they were related to her cancer or not. I think in retrospect, they may have been because they have disappeared. in subsequent scans and have not recurred. But they were too small to characterize, too small to biopsy. And we already had a confirmatory biopsy from her bone, suggesting that whatever we were seeing in her scans was related to her previous ER-positive cancer. So, as I said, she was obviously in a lot of pain at that time, which improved after the surgery and pain medication. Had palliative radiation for that area and was discharged and saw me in clinic. And in the hospital, we had already started her. We gave her a dose of zoledronic acid. We started her on tamoxifen. And once she came to clinic, we discussed the potential benefit of rendering her postmenopausal so we could use better endocrine therapies such as either AIs, like an AI instead of using tamoxifen, and potentially avoiding the need for having to use an LHRH agonist since she already was done with having kids and was in her early 40s. We also discussed the possibility, and now had stage 4 disease, the possibility of undergoing an oophorectomy, which she did agree. So she had a laparoscopic bilateral sumpingual oophorectomy. And at that point, we switched her from tamoxifen to an AI and also discussed that since enough time had elapsed between her radiation, palliative radiation to the hip, to seeing us in clinic, we would also start a CDK4/6 inhibitor, considering that she had several bones affected by her tumor and she was young. So we wanted to maximize her response to first-line treatment.
And which CDK inhibitor do you use?
I use palbociclib.
Okay, in a second, I'm going to ask you kind of to go through the three, but just sort of backtracking a little bit in terms of her management there in that situation. First of all, any thoughts about, I don't know how much pain she was in or what the location, whether you thought radiation was going to be able to handle it, but any thoughts about, like, one of the strategies you hear people using for years, decades actually, is like induction chemo to, quote, get things under control and then using hormones. Do you ever use that kind of strategy? For example, if she had multiple sites of pain that you couldn't radiate everything, what would cause your visceral disease? Do you ever use that strategy of chemo first? And if you do that, do you hold the hormonal therapy till it's done?
For patients that present with very bulky, very symptomatic disease, I would consider chemotherapy induction first before endocrine therapy if somebody had true visceral crisis. So when I say bulky disease, I'm actually thinking more organ involvement. So a lot of lung disease causing shortness of breath or liver disease causing pain. So truly very symptomatic, very bulky disease. Bone-only disease, I am a little hesitant to jump the gun on chemotherapy induction, even if in multiple spots that you couldn't radiate, because for a lot of times you can still control it well with oral opioids. And strangely enough, when you start bisphosphonates or something like denosumab, it really does seem to help quite quickly with the pain. But in patients with very symptomatic visceral disease, then I would consider induction chemotherapy before starting endocrine therapy. For this patient, the brunt of the pain that she had was in the hip, and that actually got much better control after the surgery. But she did have a pathological fracture, so she really needed just to have the consolidation radiation. And at that point, the pain was actually well controlled. So there was no need to consider induction chemotherapy for her, even though she was premenopausal and had bone disease in several spots.
Was the pathologic fracture an acute event? What was she doing?
So it was a hairline, like she hadn't broken where she collapsed, but she was playing with her kids and running and all of a sudden felt that her leg gave out and heard a pop. So I have a terrific pain, couldn't do weight-bearing activities anymore, and that's what brought her into the hospital. So it wasn't a displaced fracture, it was more of a hairline fracture, but obviously it was enough to require fixation.
How old are her children?
Right now, her oldest is 14. And the youngest is 9. She has 3 kids.
I was interested by the fact that you said you delayed starting the palbociclib because of the radiation therapy. How much radiation does it take to get you to want to think about that? Now, here she's getting a fair amount of marrow, you know, with the hip radiated. What about, you know, lesser degrees of radiation, you know, in an extremity, for example?
So I think if the palliative radiation had to be, let's say, in a rib or in a humerus, whatnot, I wouldn't have a problem going ahead with a CDK4/6 inhibitor right away. But because she really needed to have radiation in a location where a substantial amount of marrow is present, such as the hip, I was a little afraid of starting her on palbo right away and risk having to not figure out what happens to her counts or potentially like reducing the dose for palbo in an unnecessary way from the get-go. I wanted to maximize her benefit as much as I could.
So maybe we could just talk a little bit about CDK inhibitors, and particularly in terms of what we know about the three that are now available, you know, maybe just as sort of a, you know, kind of go through your vision, maybe how you explain to your fellows or if you're going to give a talk about why it is that we see benefit from CDK inhibitors, particularly obviously in combination with hormonal therapies at kind of a mechanistic level, and globally what the impact is in the metastatic setting.
So in order to explain the benefit from CDK4/6 inhibitors, I'm going to go back and talk a little bit about primary and acquired endocrine therapy resistance, because that does play a role on how do we decide to add targeted treatments to endocrine therapy. So for the most part, ER-positive tumors have sensitivity to endocrine therapies. We all know that, and we've been using these endocrine therapies now for tens of years with a lot of success, both in the adjuvant and in the metastatic setting. So ultimately, there are tumors that have what we call primary resistance to endocrine therapy, which are the cancers that don't respond to endocrine therapy from the get-go, meaning clinically that would be patients that either have a recurrence of their cancer while they are receiving adjuvant treatment or very shortly after completing adjuvant treatment, usually within the first 6 months to a year. For patients in the metastatic setting, we can tease those patients out by observing progression of disease that happens within the first 6 months of being exposed to the first-line endocrine therapy treatment. So these are cancers that don't have as much of a dependency on estrogen blockade as other cancers do. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But a lot of the common ones are the ability to engage pathways that normally would help the cancer continue to proliferate and survive independent of estrogen. One of these pathways is the cyclin D pathway, which is ultimately a target for CDK4/6 inhibitors, not the pathway as a whole, but at least an important node on the pathway. Whereas cancers that have what we call acquired resistance, which are those tumors that respond well to endocrine therapy to begin with, so patients that have a good number of years of disease-free interval between completing their adjuvant therapy and developing metastatic disease, or once they present, let's say, hypothetically with de novo ER-positive metastatic disease, take years to have disease progression on first-line endocrine therapy. Those cancers develop the ability to circumvent estrogen blockade by engaging other pathways, and the main one in that sense is the PI3 kinase pathway, to a lesser extent, the cyclin D pathway. There are other factors in acquired resistance, such as the event of ESR1 mutations and whatnot, but to make things simple, if we were to break it down primary and acquired resistance, with primary resistance, the cyclin D pathway becomes a very important tool to determine that, and PI3 kinase pathway is a pathway that is normally engaged more in acquired resistance. So years ago, when the first targeted treatment approved by the FDA to be used in conjunction with endocrine therapies, in this case, everolimus, based on the big phase 3 trial called Bolero 2, that strategy worked very well for second and third line endocrine therapies and not so well in first line treatment because, again, biologically speaking, the PI3 kinase pathway is not a pathway that is like necessarily engaged in primary resistance to endocrine therapy. So in first-line treatment in metastatic setting, most women actually do well with endocrine therapy alone, not requiring PI3 kinase pathway blocker in order to have a better outcome than using endocrine therapy alone. But all the patients that had primary resistance actually didn't do well with either. Once CDK4/6 inhibitors were explored, the idea was to capture some of these women with primary resistance. And that's where we see a big brunt of benefit coming about when we use these agents in first line, where you prevent proliferation of cancers and interfere with the estrogen pathway as well because they crosstalk. And ultimately, this strategy turned out to be very successful in first-line treatment because now we not only saw a differential on the benefit in patients that had acquired resistance to endocrine therapy, but also the ones that had primary resistance, where even the ones that had very quick progression on endocrine therapy alone still responded to the combination.
Could I just clarify one thing? Because this is really interesting. I hadn't really thought about it before. I don't know that anybody brought it up to me. So do we know right now whether or not there's a greater or different benefit of adding a CDK inhibitor to hormonal therapy in patients who've never had hormones, as opposed to those who have, even if it's not in the metastatic setting, the typical situation where somebody recurs on adjuvant hormonal therapy? Has it been looked at whether there's a difference in benefit of CDK?
The proportional benefit is the same. If you look at all three first-line trials that have been done, meaning Paloma 2, Monarch 3, Mona Lisa 2, about 20-30% of patients within those trials had de novo disease. And proportionally, the magnitude of the benefit from the addition of a CDK4/6 inhibitors in those cases was just as good, if not perhaps even a little bit better, than what you've seen with endocrine therapy alone. However, I think, and that's the part that hasn't been quite looked at, I think if you were to just subtract those patients and look at them individually, even though the hazard ratio would probably be similar, I think the benefit in terms of months of disease progression would be very impressive on both arms, where you'd probably see 40-something months of benefit from the addition of a CDK4/6 inhibitor and a good 2-3 year run with just endocrine therapy alone. So proportionally, I think the benefit is there and is the same. But when you look at the benefit that these people get from a month to month kind of deal, obviously they do a lot better than the ones that have never had endocrine exposure. It's very similar to what happened if we were to make a parallel with the use of trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the CLEOPATRA study for first-line treatment of HER2-positive disease, where within that study, a lot of the patients had never had exposure to trastuzumab before, and they were the ones that really drove the overall survival benefit that we see there. But if we were to just look at the ones that already were trastuzumab exposed in the adjuvant setting, from a hazard ratio point of view, they did just as well. When you look at their progression-free survival, it's not as great as the ones that never had seen trastuzumab before. So it's all about the context, but proportionally, the benefit is the same.
So I always love hearing new thoughts, and this is completely new. I think it's really interesting. So let me ask you, for example, do you feel less strongly about adding a CDK inhibitor to a woman who's never had hormonal therapy, who's presenting up front? You know, maybe there's a copay issue, but, you know, do you feel more comfortable? Do you have patients who you don't use a CDK inhibitor?
Absolutely. So a typical example is exactly what you said. A postmenopausal woman who has bone-only disease, is not symptomatic, lives far, doesn't really want to be bothered, has a number of other medications and is already on the donut hole. I don't want to add something else. I feel very comfortable not using a CDK4/6 inhibitor in first line for somebody like that. I don't think these medications, in the bigger scheme of things, it's very hard to prove overall survival benefit from the addition of targeted agents to endocrine therapy. And I don't think we'll ever see that. But within that thought process, what that tells me is this is not a mandatory thing. It's an option. And I think, you know, we need to let doctors be doctors. And not all patients are going to have a terrific benefit. If you were to do an exercise where you take a woman like the one I mentioned, like a postmenopausal woman, oligometastatic disease, confined to the bone, whatnot, and never seen endocrine therapy before, you keep her on endocrine therapy, chances are she's going to have a good 2-3 years before she develops progression of her cancer. And at that point, based on a number of now phase 3 clinical trials that have been done in second line, we know that she would get proportionally a good benefit from adding a CDK4/6 inhibitor at that point, along with fulvestrant. So if you count the number of months that should benefit from an AI, then from fulvestrant and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, and then potentially everolimus and another AI or continued fulvestrant, whatnot, I suspect that we're going to see a very similar progression-free survival overall on endocrine therapies in general, compared to somebody who uses a CDK4/6 inhibitor in first line, let's say, hypothetically, fulvestrant and everolimus in second line, and then you kind of like, well, then what do? I go to chemo. So all in all, I think that combined progression-free survival is probably very similar, regardless if you use a CDK4/6 inhibitor in first or in second line. So I don't feel compelled to use a CDK4/6 inhibitor up front on everybody, particularly people with de novo disease, which are bound to do well with endocrine therapy for a long time.
That's interesting. Although, you know, you hear these arguments about, I was flashing on maintenance or rituximab and follicular lymphoma, you know, what's the value of actually delaying progression or relapse? And, you know, from a quality of life, psychosocial point of view, certainly that's something to think about.
Oh, plus the financial toxicity. But I think the bigger scheme of things, if with more mature data, which I doubt we would see it, but with more mature data, we figured out that There's indeed no overall survival advantage for using these agents in first or in second line. As I said, it is not mandatory, and I think we have to individualize recommendations based on the patients that we are seeing. I think the brunt of patients will still probably get a CDK4/6 inhibitor as first line, but I can easily see a 10-20% of people that may not need to go down that road.
So I don't know how much we're going to even get to talk about HER2-positive disease, but I'm curious about your thoughts that you were talking about in terms of Cleopatra. So does that mean that if you have a patient who presents with metastatic disease, as opposed to somebody who had prior anti-HER adjuvant therapy, if they present without having been treated, you're more likely, do you ever not give them pertuzumab?
No, and that's a very different situation because there is survival benefit with the addition of pertuzumab. So that's very different. I'm talking about a situation in ER-positive disease where we don't see a survival advantage. So in HER2-positive cancer, it's a different beast where the addition of pertuzumab in first line has been associated with impressive survival benefit. And I would feel very strongly that everybody needs to be exposed to pertuzumab in first line, regardless of prior trastuzumab exposure or not.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll get to some of those HER2 issues. But just to finish out on this lady, I see, or as you mentioned, she went on palbo, gasarolin, letrozole, and zoledronic acid, and she had her ovaries taken out. And I guess she was on that for 2 years. And what happened at that point? She had disease progression?
Very minimal disease progression. She actually had literally 3 new spots show up, like tiny, tiny spots, one in her spine, one of her femur, and one of her ribs. They weren't there before. That was both confirmed both by CAT scan and bone scan. And at that point, we discussed that, you know, she probably was running out of the benefit that she was getting from the letrozole and palbo, and it was time to change. But because she was still obviously asymptomatic at this point, she has an ECOG performance status of 0. She feels great and has no side effects whatsoever from what we're doing, and still disease that is confined to the bones. We discussed participation on a clinical trial where she now has been randomized to receive either fulvestrant by itself or fulvestrant plus ribociclib. This is a placebo-controlled trial, so we don't know what she's getting. I suspect we're going to find quickly based on her counts. But nevertheless, this is a clinical trial exploring the value of continuation of CDK4/6 inhibition and switching the type of endocrine therapy that patients are getting. So she went from getting letrozole to fulvestrant and getting, in this case, a different CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Just out of curiosity, if she hadn't gone in the trial, if there wasn't a trial available, how would you have treated her off trial?
The two things I discussed with her, aside from the trial, is either consideration for fulvestrant alone or a combination of fulvestrant and everolimus. I don't feel particularly strongly towards one or the other in her case, precisely because she's very asymptomatic and really does not have any soft tissue disease. So I could have easily gone with fulvestrant alone.
I'm curious what your experience is with mucositis with everolimus and how do you deal with it?
So nowadays, in using an mTOR inhibitor such as everolimus, most of us are using prophylactic mouthwash with dexamethasone. So the rationale behind that is that, as some of you may know, an mTOR inhibitor, just like many other of these targeted agents, is metabolized by CYP3A4 system. And steroids in general, dexamethasone being an obvious one, potentially would inactivate mTOR when given at the same time. So one of the contraindications in terms of drug-drug interactions, like you wouldn't want to take steroids at the same time as you're taking an mTOR inhibitor. But the whole point of using the dexamethasone mouthwash in a swish and spit fashion is to really prevent the effects of mTOR inhibition in the mucosal area of that area of the GI tract. So just like an mTOR inhibitor can cause mucositis, not just in the mouth area, but also throughout the GI tract that would be perceived by some patients as indigestion or diarrhea or whatnot, the use of this dexamethasone solution has really dramatically cut down on the incidence and severity of mucositis. So in this day and age, because we start up front and we counsel them to use that religiously 4 times a day and whatnot, I have not seen any more mucositis with everolimus. So in essence, it has become actually a very well-tolerated drug because most people don't really have much in terms of GI side effects, and mucositis was the biggest deal. So nowadays, everolimus, I think from a side effect point of view, is really not really that much different than a CDK4/6 inhibitor.
So I apologize, but, you know, we just got off on a tangent and we were talking about a lot of things. I don't think we're going to be able to get through all your cases, but let's do one HER2 positive case just so we can at least touch into that briefly. And you have this 48-year-old lady with metastatic disease. And I, rather than go through the whole case, I just want to touch on a couple of points about her case that kind of reflect a lot of questions that we get from oncologists in practice. So the first question I have is, she presented in 2012, so it was a few years ago, and she got neoadjuvant therapy. And at that point, she just got trastuzumab with the neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and she got trastuzumab post-op as adjuvant therapy. But I just wanted to ask you, because it really is one of the most common questions we get from oncologists. Nowadays, a patient like that, I think for sure, would have gotten pertuzumab as part of neoadjuvant therapy. And she, unfortunately, had significant residual disease. But I'm just kind of curious right now, in the more typical situation today, when you have a patient getting neoadjuvant therapy that includes pertuzumab, how do you approach the issue of whether to use the pertuzumab post-op in situation A, like her, where she had a lot of disease, situation B, with a path CR?
You know, for the longest time, before the AFFINITY trial results, we were not able to use pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting, but still able to use it in the new adjuvant setting. So a lot of these people were being treated with pertuzumab up front and not receiving pertuzumab later, and many of them actually did well. We know based on all the trials done up to now that single agent HER2 targeted treatments work well just for a small subset of patients. Like, the secret sauce really seems to be in combining chemotherapy with the HER2 targeted treatment. So the brunt of the addition of pertuzumab benefit is probably coming when that is combined with trastuzumab and the chemotherapy up front, and possibly not as much as the quote unquote maintenance that is given once patients complete their chemotherapy. So for somebody who achieves a pathologic complete CR, I don't feel so strongly about continuing pertuzumab at that point, because we know that by having achieved a pathologic complete response, the outcome of that patient is going to be good, and maybe they'll do just fine with trastuzumab alone. Whereas somebody who has residual disease, who still is at high risk of having a recurrence, you'd want to spruce up that maintenance treatment as much as possible, although I'd argue that patient's probably going to do poorly anyway because they've already been exposed to trastuzumab and pertuzumab before their surgery, so they may not do well regardless of that. But typically my algorithm is I discuss continuing the pertuzumab even for patients of pathologic complete response, just because if it worked before, like, maybe we'll be doing a better job, but I don't feel strongly about continuing. So I give them the option of continuing or not based on tolerance. And I'll say it's usually a 50-50. But for patients that have residual disease, I do continue pertuzumab for the full year duration.
So the other question I wanted to ask you, relating again back to her case, is unfortunately she did develop metastatic disease. Mm-hmm. Looks like she did well with a sort of Cleopatra type approach, and then ended up going on T-DM1, so pretty typical course for people to take. But the one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know if you even thought about it in her case or whether you ever even do it, is, you know, she had ER-positive disease. And we do have the data that just got published in the JCO in the PERTAIN trial that looked at the strategy of endocrine therapy plus HER therapy, pertuzumab and trastuzumab without chemo. And I'm curious whether you ever utilized that strategy. Did you consider, for example, in her?
So in her, I didn't, because she had a lot of visceral disease at that point and was somewhat symptomatic when she presented. So she would not have been a typical patient where I would have considered that. But for people that have oligometastatic disease, very asymptomatic, ER-positive disease, and very strong expression of HER2, I potentially could discuss that as management. I feel a little uneasy about withholding a treatment such as Cleopatra-like treatment just because of the survival advantage we see with that. So I think until we see more data as far as, is the survival advantage maintained when you withhold the chemo as first line? So I think there's a place in the sun for a chemo-less regimen, but I don't think it's for everybody. I would be more tempted to consider it in an elderly patient with comorbidities and somebody who has oligometastatic disease, possibly confined to the bone, and I would be more tempted to do that. But for the majority of people, I'd probably just use a regimen with a taxane, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab first line just because of the survival advantage with that.
So one final question. One other thing that's kind of come about during the course of this lady's therapy. So I think the way her timing came out, probably she wasn't offered the option of neratinib, which we now have for about a year as a possibility in terms of post-adjuvant therapy. But I'm curious how you approach that issue. Do you ever offer it to a patient who's ER negative, HER2 positive? This lady was ER positive. Do you offer it to people in the neoadjuvant setting? And also wonder if you could comment on the data that I know you were part of the study. It was just presented at ASCO, looking at the duration of neratinib and treatment benefit. So any comment on that whole thing?
Neratinib, which is not an antibody, is a HER1 and HER2 kinase inhibitor, has indeed been looked into an extended approach post-completion of adjuvant trastuzumab as another way of potentially reducing risk of recurrences in patients with HER2-positive cancer that had at least stage 2 or stage 3 disease at presentation. And indeed, there is substantial, not super substantial, but definitely statistically significant and clinically significant benefit from the addition of neratinib, particularly in the patients that have ER-positive disease. Not saying that there's no benefit in ER-negative disease, but particularly in the ER-positive cancers where there is a synergism between endocrine therapy blockade and HER2 blockade, where the brunt of benefit was higher. Nevertheless, in this day and age, because we have pertuzumab that we're using for patients with stage 2 and stage 3 at presentation, either in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant fashion, a lot of the data that was explored with neratinib is questionably applicable because when the EXANET study that looked at neratinib in the adjuvant setting, pertuzumab wasn't around. So it's hard to say what to do and how to combine these two strategies now because they may be complementary or they may be useless. The neratinib may not have added any benefit once you've treated somebody with pertuzumab. So since we're not going to have that data, the way I'm using the available data and extrapolating as best as I can is the following. For patients that have high-risk disease, and when I say that, I'm going to define that as patients that are diagnosed as stage 2 or stage 3 at presentation, get treated in neoadjuvant setting, and still have residual disease at the time of surgery. The other patients that I would include in this group are obviously the one that present with inflammatory disease, which is not common, but it's potentially a little bit more common with patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. So in these patients that have very high risk of recurrence, either because of residual disease or because they present with inflammatory cancer to begin with, I am very aggressive with them, and I really tend to do the whole thing where I give them chemo with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, do the trastuzumab and pertuzumab for the whole year, and then expose them to neratinib as well a year after that. If their risk is not as high, I would confine the neratinib recommendation usually to ER-positive disease, but if their risk is high enough, then even if they don't have ER-positive cancers, I would consider the addition of neratinib as well, in the spirit of trying to lower as much as possible the risk of recurrence.
Subsequent to these interviews, the primary results from the Phase 3 IMpassion 130 trial were presented at the ESMO 2018 meeting and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showing that the addition of atezolizumab to nab-paclitaxel significantly improved progression-free survival when used in first-line treatment of patients with advanced triple-negative breast cancer in both the intention-to-treat population and the PD-L1 positive subgroup. At this first interim survival analysis, a clinically meaningful improvement was also reported among patients with PD-L1 positive tumors, where the overall survival was increased by 10 months with a hazard ratio of 0.62. The result of the Phase 3 Paloma 3 study was also presented at ESMO and published in the New England Journal, demonstrating that the addition of palbociclib to fulvestrant resulted in a statistically significant improvement in overall survival in patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative advanced breast cancer who were sensitive to previous endocrine therapy with a hazard rate of 0.72. In addition, also presented at ESMO were the results of the Phase 3 SOLAR-1 study evaluating the addition of alpelisib to fulvestrant for patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease and one prior line of endocrine therapy. Progression-free survival was significantly prolonged with the addition of the PI3 kinase inhibitor alpelisib to fulvestrant, with a hazard rate of 0.65 in patients with PIK3CA mutations. This is the first study to show statistically significant, clinically meaningful PFS improvement with an alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitor in this patient population. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.